future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Welcome to Raging Chickens, Out to Coop Live call-in show for Monday, October 26, 2020. This week at Out to Coop Live, every single week we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sort from our own backyards from across the country. On Friday, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics, and you can get both by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. But you can only join the conversation live through the Podbean app on Mondays at 10:30 a.m. Eastern. You know, we're also back streaming live on our YouTube station, too, as well. So you go over YouTube, click on Raging Chicken, look for us there. We'll be streaming live there, too, as well. I will be monitoring the comments on YouTube as well. You can support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month at patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show on the Podbean app, you can show us some love right now. You drop a few bucks in our tip jar by clicking on the little gift icon at the bottom of your screen. Fill your digital pockets with Podbean's golden beans. That's what they call them. I have no control over that, folks. That's the golden beans. And send us a gift of your choice. Every gift you send helps support and expand this podcast. If you're looking for more PA progressive talk, tune in to Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channel, Twitter, or Facebook, wherever it is, you know, wherever streams live, or subscribe to his podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm going to give a special shout out once again to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our theme song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at @SongADayMan. That's @SongADayMan with two N's, M-A-N-N, SongADayMan. He holds like the Guinness Book of World Records for writing the most consecutive day songs or most numbers of songs in consecutive days, however you put that. It's pretty crazy. On today's show, I am thrilled to welcome Tara Zirinsky to the show. Tara is a Democratic Party candidate for state rep in the Lehigh Valley's 138th State House District, and that's in Northampton County. If you haven't been paying attention to this race, well, now's the time. Tara is campaigning on health care for all, protecting our environment, and protecting our democracy from corruption and the influence of big money. But more than that, she has consulted with nurses, workers, environmentalists, and community organizations to craft integrated policies that put the health of working families and our communities first. And this is the kind of big things, like when you run a campaign that's got grassroots support, when you send this person to the state house, you're sending those organizations and their power with them too as well. This is what we want. Little background, Tara was born and raised in Bethlehem, and she was elected to Northampton County. She was elected as a Northampton County Councilwoman in 2017. She's been an advocate for clean energy and sustainability. She's worked as a solar energy consultant for Sun Pulse Solar, supplementing her adjunct faculty career teaching philosophy at Northampton Community Colleges, Lehigh County Community College, and Lehigh University. And any listener to Out the Coop knows well about the struggles and challenges faced by adjunct faculty, as that has been one of the things that we've been hamping on for years. Tara is the chair of the Energy, Environment, and Land Use Committee in Northampton County and a member of the committee of the same name at the County of Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. In 2018, she formed the Industrial Hemp Ad Hoc Committee for Industrial Hemp to explore the economic development potential of the emerging crop and identify areas necessitating government support for farmers, industrial hemp business entrepreneurs. And in 2015, this has got to be one of my little favorite details, right? She published her first children's book, All Ducks Are Birds, But Not All Birds Are Ducks, a logic book for children, which she wrote and illustrated. Now, she just got a huge endorsement for Bernie Sanders coming out this week, or a couple weeks ago, and she's going to be one of the battalion of candidates of progressives that are organizing to help take back the PA House and turn it blue. You can check out all her stuff at www.voteforzirinsky.org, and that's the number four, voteforzirinsky.org. You just click right down to the show notes, it'll take you right there. Tara, welcome to the show. I am so excited about your race and so excited to talk to you today.
Thank you. I'm pretty excited to be here too. I mean, this is really awesome. We don't have a whole lot of opportunities to talk live or to get out and reach a massive amount of people live. And so this is a great opportunity to get our message out. So thank you.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, like very much like the campaign that you're running. I mean, what when where we sit here with Raging Chicken, it's always been the idea is that we need to begin. And we need to, you know, this is why we've been here since 2011 to sort of build out, say, a grassroots, independent, progressive media from the ground up, right? So that we have these spaces where we can actually have these kind of conversations. So it's pretty awesome. And what's pretty exciting about your race, too, as well, is that, you know, this is, I mean, I think this is, you know, your race is the kind of race that I think that many in this, say, PA Democratic Party for a long time, or the, you know, like the state, you know, even beyond just the Democratic Party, but looked at kind of, say, Northampton County and say, okay, yeah, this has been a Republican district, but that's not been the case. And one of the things that one of my hobby horses here on this show has been that, in my view, the Lehigh Valley really is the future of Pennsylvania progressive politics, right? It has been fairly much kind of ignored in terms of digging out, say, the grassroots work that's going on, ignored by as a potential place to invest a lot of energy. And yet campaigns like yours and what we saw even in the last election cycle are really demonstrating that no, Northampton County, the 138th district, is ready to bring a progressive to the state house.
I believe so, too. And one of the things that's really unique about this district is that not only was it a pivot county, you know, Northampton County, but this district specifically has over 8,000 independents registered. That's a huge number of people who are disenchanted or disenfranchised by either the Democratic or the Republican Party. And they're looking for a candidate to represent them that might not fit into either one of the molds. And right. I feel like the progressives really do that. That's why I feel like this county and this 138th district flipped and went from voting from Obama to Trump in 2016.
Yep.
This same county voted for Tom Wolf.
Yep.
So...
No, I absolutely. Well, before we get into like looking at some specific policies, I definitely want to dig into some of this stuff. Let me just ask you, you know, just to kind of say a baseline question, mm-hmm. is that what brought you to this point? I mean, why did you decide to run? Why did you decide to kind of launch this campaign? What do you hope that this campaign is actually, you know, going to be able to accomplish?
Well, the reason why I ran was I was in a grassroots campaign against the Pennies Pipeline. I was an organizer for Food and Water Watch. And working in that grassroots campaign, I realized how much corruption there is in politics, how much profit drives policy. And I really wanted a seat at the table. In my Northampton County, I became a Northampton County councilwoman because I thought I could influence things in that way. And to some extent, I've still continued my grassroots campaign to talk about environmental issues in the county, which, you know, once I got to the table, I realized, wow, there's a lot more going on here.
Right.
I mean, I knew during my campaign there was issues about sludge and landfill expansion and clean air and clean water. And now we're talking about the introduction of emerging crops like industrial hemp and how that can impact the economic development here. And also, we have an issue with a dewatering of the Bushkill Creek.
Right.
So there's so many things to do here. And at the county level, what I realize is so much money comes from the state. And we have to wait for that money. If it's not budgeted, we don't get a piece of it. And then it falls on the backs of homeowners here for property taxes and things like that. It's very difficult. We're trying to preserve land here at a high rate because we have warehouse development and just development in general for a lot of luxury housing that's really taken the people who live here, who've lived here their whole entire lives, for granted. You know, they can't afford the houses that are here now.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's like we're pricing out our people.
Well, we're pricing out our people at the same time that we're kind of, you know, removing the very things, you know, I mean, literally like the land that very yeah. often that people and residents of those areas who've grown up and generations have grown up in these areas have, you know, have cherished. And then and you've removed all the jobs through like horrible trade deals that have happened kind of at the federal level. That's obviously beyond mm-hmm. what we could do at the state, but have kind of like, you know, have lost these jobs and we're replacing them with jobs that, you know, if people take these jobs, like these big warehouse jobs, like the Amazon jobs that are kind of springing up all over the place, they can't afford those places that are springing up, those like luxury homes that are springing up in that very area. Right. You know, when I see this, you know, I teach at Kutztown University too, and I see this at my, you know, from some of my students who talk about, you know, their families being left with no choice but to have to kind of sell their farm. Right. Because yes. the property taxes are getting pushed up because of all these kind of luxury homes that are pulling in. And they're finding out they have fewer and fewer job opportunities in the area.
Yes. What people don't realize is that when your population expands, you have more services necessary per head.
Right.
So that all comes out of your budget. You know what I mean? So now our, you know, children, youth services, our police force, any human services, they're stretched thin because they're trying to expand at the same rate that everything else is. And it's almost impossible to cover all the needs. But we do it because we have to.
Right.
But people are starting to fall through the cracks. Like as an adjunct professor, I can remember thinking, wow, $16 an hour is pretty good. And then sort of like slapping myself in the head and thinking, the reason why I think that's good is because I'm working for $26,000
exactly.
a year.
Exactly.
That's not livable.
Right.
And then
exactly.
you just have to think like, these aren't livable wages. And for like a brief moment in time, like I have a pastoral counseling degree. So I became a counselor and I talked to a lot of people coming through my office. You know, and they're stressed out and stretched thin, and a lot of their anxiety and a lot of their stressors, like psychological, come from the ability not to pay their bills, wondering how they are going to, you know, pay their rent or get food or can they get another job. And I remember this one person in particular who worked at Amazon. That individual told me how stressful that job is because everything's timed.
Yeah.
You know, everything, like not just going to the bathroom, but how many things you can sort and how many things you can pick in like a short span of time. And you're working 10-hour shifts with little to no break. And you're just thinking like, wow, the stress that we put on people for so little money because we think that that job doesn't have a value is beyond me. And I use this one example a lot. Like when I was in Germany, I lived there as an au pair, and one of my friends stocked cans, mm-hmm. like stocked shelves at like the Food Lion or something
exactly.
like that. You know, they made 25 Deutschmarks an hour.
Yep.
In 1998, 25 Deutschmarks was a livable wage. And I was like, wow, why do you get paid so much for that? Because in my concept that has been ingrained in me, I thought, yeah, that's a lower level job. That's not as valuable as somebody who does. My time's just as valuable as anybody else's because it's time. In the United States, we trade our hours for dollars and we allow somebody to value us and pretty much value our lives to that capacity. And for some people, they have very little choice in what job they can get. But in Germany, I remember thinking like everybody's valued in that society because they contribute. And yes, some people make more and some people make less, but they're able to live a pretty nice standard. Like that person got off at 4 o'clock and then could go to, you know, the cafe and have a drink and have a scone or something or whatever it was, or have a beer. Cause that was like the big thing in Germany, you know?
No, right. Absolutely. You know, I think that, you know, one of the things that to go along with what you're saying is like, you know, I remember growing up, and I grew up in Utica, New York, right, upstate New York. And mm-hmm. One of the things that I can remember talking about with my friends, like, you know, Utica in the 70s and 80s was watching all of its industry disappear, right? I mean, mm-hmm. shops are closing down. The downtown was, you know, basically boarded up. As all these really good paying jobs, you know, that had been there through, you know, we had a textile industries, we had a GE plant, we had silverware factories and China factory, all gone. And we watch all that mm-hmm. stuff go around. And so my friends and I, you know, I remember all sit around talking about the only thing we wanted to do was get out. right? And one things that the narratives that we learned, right? And this wasn't just, you know, my friends and I, this is what we saw on TV, this we saw everything was just like, you know, you just need to kind of like go to school, get a degree so that you'll never have to do those jobs. And you were mm-hmm. taught at a very young age to somehow like diminish work, right? Mm-hmm. Diminish what would have meant to be hard work. And, you know, I think in part of the last, say, 5-10 years, right, especially since the 2008, 2009 economic collapse, people are beginning to kind of really question that narrative, right? And yeah. try to expose it for the first time ever and say, well, wait a minute, I thought we valued hard work. And I don't know anybody who works at an Amazon factory or Amazon warehouse or anybody who works at a quote unquote low level job who does not work hard. And the one benefit, I mean, if you can call it a benefit, I hate to even use that language for this, but the one thing that, say, the pandemic has shone a light on is how we define what an essential worker is, right? How do we define right. who is absolutely critical to our economy? And suddenly people started looking at, like, you know, the checkout person at the grocery store and the Amazon driver and the Amazon warehouse worker in a little bit of different light, because suddenly that was shown and exposed of how absolutely critical that was for the jobs. And why on earth would those be the people that are going to be denied a living wage, denied health care, right, and run into the ground? I mean, this is just unconscionable in so many ways.
It is, definitely. But see, those same people that we call heroes and essential workers are the same people that we're still paying the same amount
exactly.
of money. The same people that may or may not have health care. The same people who their businesses are closing. You know, and I think Bethlehem and the Lehigh Valley is very similar to what you said about Utica, New York.
100%.
Because we had the steel. Everybody worked in some industry, steel, cement, whatever it was around here. There was a lot of manufacturing, a lot of construction kind of materials. And when that went away, we had a real lull in redefining ourselves. But we did redefine ourselves almost like in this service industry where people work in restaurants. They have boutiques and stores. Small businesses grew out of this. And now we're seeing Main Street suffer.
Yep.
Like, and it's unconscionable the way large corporations have taken the wealth of COVID money and just amplified it for themselves, and how the small businesses are struggling. And these are the people that employ our friends and neighbors. They're, you know, the restaurants that we love to go to before the pandemic, who are now struggling at 50% capacity. And having worked in a restaurant, you know, that industry for over 20 years, I know.
Yep.
Like, you can't survive on 50% capacity. You can't stock your pantry. You can't run a menu. You can't stock liquor. You can't tap that much beer. It'll go bad. You know, so you're, and a lot of these like micro breweries and wineries and places like that, everybody's really struggling now. And that's why they want to reopen. There's
right.
this idea that people, even before the pandemic, went to work sick because they had no choice. They have to make money. And I feel like even though this is a pandemic, the gravity of it all has been lost in the polarization and the usage of this crisis as a political wedge. And it's sad that this is happening, because what we should be doing is pulling together as a community and saying, okay, our businesses are struggling. What can we do to help? At the state level, we need like 1% loans to keep these businesses afloat. We need to have mass testing so that we can make sure that people are healthy. We need functional PPE, do you know, and for everybody.
Absolutely.
We need to be able to modify these locations so that they're safe, so that our schools are safe. We need to not overwhelm our healthcare workers because people don't want to wear masks. Do you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
this idea of freedom, and I teach philosophy. So when you talk about freedom, you're talking about the freedom to and the freedom from.
Right.
Where your freedom to intersects with my freedom from, that's where law is supposed to come in and mitigate that middle ground. Because there is a moral imperative to care about other people, to make sure that they're safe. And we know that this COVID crisis is not just the flu.
Right.
If you have any friends or family members who have suffered and even died from this, you know that they have had the struggle is real, you know, and we don't even know. We don't even know the implications of this virus.
Right, exactly.
It might have long-term impacts on your health and well-being and everything else.
I mean, I'm so glad you said that, because this is one of the things I think that that so many people miss in here. It's like, even, you know, there was a study that came out from Penn State not too long ago, or Penn State was at least citing this one. They were looking at what's been the impact of the pandemic on, say, college athletes, because they were finding that there was these outbreaks that were taking place. You know, teams would get together, colleges start up, teams get together and practice. They didn't know if they're going to have seasons yet, but then they would have these spikes and outbreaks, especially in areas of the country or kind of where they're, you know, they had the resistance to wearing a mask or social distance, whatever it might be. And what they found is that in of the cases that tested positive, it was something of the order of, I want to say 30%. That might be a conservative estimate. It might be a little bit higher than that, but I want to say 40, but I'll say 30 conservatively, that they found that they had kind of like heart damage, right? That was going to, that they were going to have to watch now, right, for the next decade or so, right, to see if that stuff would heal. And so those were students, right? Those are students, those are college athletes that didn't, that were not kind of like, you know, on ventilators in the hospital, right? Some of them were even asymptomatic, and yet they still had that kind of impact on their hearts. So when we're talking about this as a healthcare crisis, right? When we're talking about this as a crisis, we're talking about not just for, okay, let's make sure that we have enough ventilators in the hospital now, but we're going to have to talk about a strategy and a plan for long-term care for good portions of our population, especially as we're heading in to yet another peak, as Pennsylvania just this week has announced record cases of coronavirus, like record cases as in more cases than the original peak. Right. So, I mean, I don't know how you move forward without that kind of, you know, the idea about healthcare being at the forefront. And let me say this too, as well. This is one of the things that I absolutely love about the way that you've articulated a lot of your kind of, you know, main platform agendas, is that they're integrated with each other. Right. So healthcare is not separate from jobs. Right. It's not separate from our environment. Is that it's integrated like from one to the other. And the fact that you've been kind of in consultation with, say, for example, the PA nurses, right? And consultation with environmental groups, in consultation with, you know, labor organizations. I mean, I take a look at just your like series of endorsements here. I mean, it's like two pages printed of endorsements, right? I mean, I mean, of all the folks that are kind of have gotten behind this campaign, have been consulted this campaign. And I believe that what you're kind of been able to articulate is saying, look, this is not about urban versus rural. This is not about, you know, those who have and, you know, those who have health insurance and those we're just going to try to get into health insurance. This is not kind of like whether you have a job or not. It's like, no, how do we actually create a society and a community that can thrive? Right. And then how do you and all these people who have been kind of who have been organizing, have been trying to do this separately, has seemed to come together around your campaign and saying, yes, we see that in order to kind of make sure that we have a sustainable community, we may need to make sure that we have jobs that can pay a living wage. And we need to have health care. Right. And we need to have an agricultural policy and a farm preservation policy and environmental policy that kind of cherishes and supports and protects those areas of our community. Right. Which are integral for the rest of the state. And it's not this opposition between the rural and the urban, or, you know, and one or the other. And that's what's, I think, amazing to me. And kind of going back to that point that you made early on, is I think that was what was missing in the last presidential campaign, right? Which ever since 2016, we begin to see this kind of like this rise of candidates coming from the local level who have refused this kind of like easy dichotomy and have looked at their communities and say, we need help. And we need a fighter that is going to be in and is going to go to the state house that is going to join that fight with others.
Well, that's one, like later on today, I have another event to go to. And one of the questions that they're going to ask is, what is your superpower? And and my superpower is really coalition building and connecting different groups, because what I see is the system. I see how the system works and how the parts fit together and what needs to be changed, because we can't change one thing and expect everything else to stay the same, because you change one thing and it does change everything else to some degree, such that it might not work. So when you look at the system, like healthcare, the environment, public education, criminal justice system, the economy, property taxes. It's basically, how do we revise everything that we've been doing and recreate a society that works for everybody in consultation with a government that is actually going to work for people and not for corporations? Because currently, I mean, that's what we're seeing in Harrisburg. We're seeing legislators bought and paid for because we don't have a gift ban. We're seeing legislators working to the benefit of corporations and getting kickbacks in their back pocket, and then going through the revolving door, coming out the other side with a really nice cushy job in the industry for which they just passed legislation. I mean, we can't go on like this. No. Because we're seeing the shrinking of the middle class. 8 million people were reported to have fallen into poverty during this COVID crisis. We know that this system does not work for everybody. And as we see people slipping into poverty, we see other people deciding how to spend their wealth, like going to Mars, buying rocket ships, things that are absolutely absurd in the time where other people are, you know, devastated economically, socially, you know, physically. And to me, it's just mind-blowing that we aren't a more compassionate society at this point in time to see that we need equity and justice to be the foundation of how we define freedom.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that is so well put. And I think about what makes that possible. What's the kind of work that makes that possible? What are the kind of values that makes that possible? And I think about, you know, just caring for each other. I mean, you know, yeah. whether it's, you know, taking care of kids, right? Whether it's teachers in the classroom, whether it's nurses on the front lines, whether it's, you know, I mean, I have family members who work in nursing homes, right? My sister-in-law works in hospice. My brother-in-law works in a nursing home. My wife's in medicine, right? And it's kind of like, you know, they're involved with, you know, on those things. And I know the conditions that they're facing there. And the fact is that, you know, they're poorly paid, right? And they're feeling the same pressures that warehouse worker at Amazon is, right? You know, despite what they want to do and provide the care that's necessary for those patients, for those individuals, right? They're kind of under the gun of kind of like, no, you just need to get you don't want to lose your job now, do you? Right? You don't want to lose your job. Yeah. You better kind of like wrap it through. Sorry, otherwise we're going to have to do it. And then the people that are even kind of like new workers coming in are barely getting a living wage. And so I think about, you know, the things that become so important, that became so clear during this pandemic, right, are also that basis of looking forward. So not just kind of how much can we extract from everybody, but how much can we care for each other? And the industries that are built around that are the ones, again, guess who works there, right? Some of the most vulnerable kind of parts of our community. And that who's vulnerable in our communities and who's kind of forced into kind of like, you know, lives of contingency and lives of kind of living on the edge is more and more of our community as more and more of the kind of wealth gets accumulated in the hands of the few. So, I mean, this is kind of like, I mean, at the baseline about the corruption, I remember, you know, we've covered like the March on Harrisburg, what they've been doing over the past several years about trying to draw attention to the fact that Pennsylvania doesn't have this gift ban, and kind of looking at, you know, these frontline workers and say, look, we got to redefine our economy. And we have to do that by say, yes, we have to respond to the immediate needs, but then we also need that vision of going forward, right? Mm-hmm. Which has to do exactly what you're saying here. It's like this has to do with, you know, coalition building and kind of taking what our needs are in our communities and translate them into policy at the state and federal level.
Exactly. And we need people who are going to actually do that, who care enough about their community, who put themselves on the line to make some of these really tough decisions, to make this policy that might not always be popular, because at the beginning, there can be growing pains, but the government needs to step in and bridge the gap and make sure that people are taken care of. Like right now, I don't feel like they're doing it. A lot of small business owners are telling me how they're gonna have to pay the PPP back and the Paycheck Protection Program money that they got. They're gonna have to pay taxes on it, and they're underwater right now in their debt, and they're looking to a future where not only is their business going to be probably shuttered, but they're looking to a future where they're so far in debt that they have very little resource to get out of it. And so this is really important because that debt lingers. And when it's at, like, the one guy was telling me, it's like 16 to 23% because he's putting much of his life on a credit card because he can't get loans right now. So what the government really needs to do is to give really low interest rate loans to people who are struggling. But yet we use those low interest rate loans for people with money, with good credit. And that's not helping our small businesses right now. They need to be sustained because they're sustaining everybody else in the community.
Absolutely.
It's and then you're looking again at a systems approach. You know, the farmer, everyone from the farmer to the person at the drugstore, to the person at, a furniture store or whatever. They all need help. You're looking at the police officers and the firefighters and the people who are educators and nurses. And you're realizing, like, there's a, like, I love children's books, so I'm just going to reference one. Richard Scarry.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember
that.
Oh,
yeah.
He made this book about everybody, like what their job is. And you like went through the town and you saw all these little animals doing these funny things with like the houses cut in like a side view so that you could look in.
Loved
and like
them.
There's a guy doing the plumbing and a guy doing construction and a nurse over there and a teacher. And you're like, these are all the jobs. But you know what? That book left out. None of them had a price tag over their head. So in your mind, you thought, oh, all these people are equal. All these people are important. It's almost like we have to get back to that and realize, wow, all these people perform an essential function in our society that if we took them out, our society would not work the same. We need all these people, even though we don't value them the same. And that's why I'm trying to fight so hard for equity and wage reform, because people shouldn't be valued by dollars. They should be valued for their inherent worth. And every amount of work that they do should have some sort of dignity attached to it, you know?
Absolutely. And I'm often reminded of, you know, my friend Rick Smith, who runs the Rick Smith Show podcast, or runs the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV too as well, would always say like that. Is like, that's what we're always hoping for, is looking for kind of elected representatives that are willing back to bring back the dignity of work. So I'm looking at the time. I know that, Tara, this is crunch time here. This is your in the final week. I mean, election day, the last day that you can vote, right, is week and a day from today. And you got a lot of campaigning to do. I want to remind everybody that, you know, if you do have a question, you want to kind of comment, you want to join the conversation, you can click that little call-in button at the bottom of the Podbean app. And you can also support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress, or you can drop a few bucks in our tip jar during the live show by clicking on that little gift icon at the bottom of your screen. I also want to remind you that you can go check out all of Tara's platforms at vote4zerinsky.org, and that's ZRINSKI.org. There'll be a link right there in the show notes. You can check this out after the show. I'm going to plop this right down in the chat. So if there's somebody that wants to check it out right now, please do. One of the things that I want to give you the opportunity of, if anybody wants to call in, that's great. Want to have a commentary. But, you know, given the fact that we're a week and a day out, right, you're in the kind of the home stretch at this point. What do you want kind of voters know, especially voters in your district, but also those ones that are around the state that are kind of supporting kind of progressive candidates? I mean, I think that, you know, your campaign, I think, popped up to a lot of people's attention to as well of late, when you got to say the Bernie Sanders endorsement kind of brought you back up to the in that news cycle again, right? Kind of looking at this connection with other legislators around the state. But in particular, what do you want, say, voters to know? What do you want citizens of Pennsylvania to know as we kind of go into this final stretch before Election Day?
I want them to know that their vote counts. You know, a lot of people are disenchanted with the two-party system, and it doesn't matter. You're voting for the person. You should look at their platform, look at what they have to say, look at how it is that they can help, and the record of what they've already accomplished. And by a head and shoulder above my opponent, I think I have accomplished that goal. I think that my COVID recovery plan, my issues, the endorsements that I have with the coalition building are testament to the kind of legislator that I want to be. Because I know that this isn't just about a D and an R in front of your name. Because you, in a representative democracy, you have to represent everybody, and you have to represent the interests of everybody. And that is what I plan to do if elected. I'm not a person who won't reach out and talk to other people to get opinions because I think they matter. But I also will do my research because that is my background. And I think that people should really know that this is a very important election.
Yes.
This is going, if we flip the PA State House, it means that we could take Pennsylvania in an entirely new direction with the anti-corruption bills alone that we could pass. It would be phenomenal if we could get a legislature that works for the people and by the people. Then we can have the kind of government, the representative democracy that actually represents the interests and welfare of the people. And during this COVID crisis, I think that we can't ask for much more.
Boy, do I hear you. Well, I'm telling you, one of the things that I want to echo, things that Tara said just now, was that you look at the platforms. Look at what and the background of someone who's going to fight for it. I'll tell you one of the reasons that I started really looking closely at what was going on in Tara Zirinsky's campaign was that it was clear that not only do we have like a Democrat who's kind of running a strong campaign in this in Northampton County, because I used to live in Allentown. I have a strong affinity to Lehigh Valley for exactly the reasons you said. I think it reminds me a lot of my own hometown, a lot of the history of my own hometown, and there's these kind of towns all over the country and certainly all over the state that have that same kind of this kind of background. And I've watched my hometown turn to kind of Trump land up there. And for the same kind of reason, they felt there's been nobody that's out there speaking for them, to them, with them, right, about the needs that are there. And I'm also reminded of a little fact that I came across this year was that, Pennsylvania has voted with the majority, like, for president, right, in all but, I think, two elections. And one of those elections was didn't vote for the other party, voted for the third party, voted for the Progressive Party, right, back in the day, because it was a combination of progressive, grassroots, citizen-based, rural and urban, kind of working-centered, working family-centered campaign that spoke to the needs of the community. And I think that we are at one of these moments right now. So not only am I looking at candidates and looking for folks that are going to say, okay, they've got some good stuff on paper, but I'm also looking for a track record, and I'm looking for somebody that can fight. And from every single issue that is on Tara's campaign, whether it's the healthcare for all, whether it's environmental protection, whether it's fair funding for public higher education and technical education, whether it's ending corruption and holding leaders accountable, whether it's workers' rights and a strong middle class, or whether it's job creations and small business support, every single one of those things she's got experience in doing on the ground. She's got experience working with organizations on the ground that are gonna fight along with her, right, to bring those changes to our state house. And as somebody who also works in higher education, as somebody who works in public higher education, and has watched what the state legislature has done, right, and this mm-hmm. has been Democrats and Republicans alike, I have to say, over the years, have defunded public education, right, have defunded our kind of infrastructures, right? I can tell you more than ever that we need fighters that are going to Harrisburg, not just a D next to the name, but somebody who's a fighter. And Tara, I got to say, you're it.
Well, thanks. That's what I'm known for, my hustle and being a fighter. I know how to survive, but beyond that, I know how to thrive. And I know how to pull other people up along with me. I'm not the kind of person who shuts the door after me, because I know that my success is other people's success. And that's the way I look at it. I really want to help Pennsylvania and the 138th succeed and thrive and give our children a future that I believe that they deserve, and that is the economy, the environment, the education system, the hope and the dream that, they're valued as human beings enough to know that their healthcare is a human right, that people are valued enough to say that criminal justice reform is necessary at this time, and that we are going to provide for them what is essential, you know what I mean, in their futures.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, you know, I know I've even taken, kept you a little bit longer than we even talked about. So I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. But two professors get together. Yeah, it's like a mass lecture.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Exactly. But I'll tell you, I wish you all the luck moving forward. Anybody who's out there in the Lehigh Valley, I know you've got an incredible team on the ground. You've got a ton of great cream of volunteers. You got folks that are out there supporting you. But if you can kind of head over to say www.voteforzerinsky.org, show her that you're supporting, contribute to her campaign if you can, get out there and kind of organize her and help bring her home, because I'm telling you, this is a big, big seat in order to flip from red to blue in order to be able to take back the state house. So, best of luck to you, Tara. And I want to message to everybody who's here too as well. We're going to do the closeout music, but I'm going to stick around a little bit after Tara is gone. So we're going to do our little kind of afterward discussion today, some other issues that are on our mind, looking ahead to Friday's show. If you want to stick around for the extended conversation afterwards, please do. But Tara, thank you so much for joining our show this week, and best of luck as you move towards the election. All right, this has been Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. This is Out the Coop Live. Thank you all for joining us. Those of you who want to stick around, please do. Hit us up at patreon.com/rcpress. See ya!